You are listening to a podcast from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Good afternoon, and welcome to the Carnegie Endowment. I'm Chris Bosek, part of the Middle East program here at Carnegie. I'd like to welcome everyone here today and our viewers on C-SPAN to what I think will be a very stimulating and informative discussion about Anwar al-Awlaki. Awlaki's been in the media an awful lot over the last several months, including being linked or accused of being linked to the Fort Hood shooter last November and the Christmas Day attack with ties reaching back to Yemen. So today we have two great speakers, Chris Heffelfinger, who's going to speak first, and Scott Shane. Chris is a consultant with the Combating Terrorism Center at West Point, as well as to the FBI, and he's author of the forthcoming book, Radical Islam in America. Chris is going to speak for about 15 or 20 minutes, and then Scott Shane will speak. Scott is a national security reporter for the New York Times. I'd like to ask everyone to turn off your phones, as they will interrupt and disrupt the speaker and the audio system. Also, during the Q&A, I'd like each of you who asked a question, please identify yourself and to phrase your question in the form of a question. With that, Chris, thank you.
Well, first I'd like to thank you, Chris, for organizing this. I think it's certainly an important topic right now. It's one more and more people have started to follow, especially since last November. So I would like to start really by, I'd like to cover three things in the next 15 minutes if we can. First of all, I'll give a brief overview of his biography, and try to account for his popularity. Why are we here talking about him today in the first place? Why is he unique? Secondly, I'd like to talk about Northern Virginia in going back about a decade. It was, I think, maybe a scene, a Salafi activist scene that not all of us are that familiar with. And I think the context of what he was preaching just leading up to 9/11 and really those critical years in the US up until 2004, the context and backdrop for those are important. So I'd like to provide some of that. And then lastly, I want to talk about his role and relationship with Al-Qaeda, specifically Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, EQAP, and really what, if any, role he has relationship with them. So, let's see. Al-Awlaki has been someone of interest to me for since 2004, 2005. He first popped up in a FBI investigation of the Northern Virginia paintball group. It was a group of 11 young men that were studying under someone named Ali al-Tamimi, who was originally Iraqi but was actually born in Washington, D.C., spent his adolescence in Saudi Arabia, and then returned. And he had been encouraging these young men to go fight in Afghanistan. And he started to appear in some of the investigation and cases and on that case file. And what really struck me and a lot of people after that was his relationship with two of the 9/11 hijackers at the mosque here in Falls Church. And so I had sort of started, kept tabs on him but from a distance, and even until today, even having this event now, it's sort of hard to peg down why is this guy significant? What has he really done? Was he instrumental in organizing an attack? Was he simply mentoring these young men towards it? Did he have any knowledge of the attacks or other attacks? It never has really been clear. Maybe that's what makes him so interesting. There's some mystery about it all still. But he was born in New Mexico in 1971, so he's coming up on his 40th birthday here. And I believe he was here until the age of nine. So he had an early foundation in the U.S., but even people that knew him after he returned at the age of 20 in 91. So he came back to Colorado and received an engineering degree. And the people that talk about him during that time say that he's missing some gaps in his American pop culture, you know, references everyone would understand as an adolescent had they grown up here, sort of went right over his head. So even from this early age, I think he's sort of torn between the two places, or at least divided between Yemen and America. So he has this period throughout the 90s until 2000 where he's sort of working his way up. He has, up until this point, no higher Islamic education. Right? He's studied in Yemen, and he has the basics. He's memorized some Quran. He's learned hadith. He's learned what any young man religious background would learn in Yemen throughout that period. But he's not considered a scholar in the U.S. He's not a cleric. He doesn't really take on that role until maybe the last two or three years. Even in his earlier time when he's preaching at San Diego or in Falls Church, he was more or less an assistant imam. He wasn't a sensation. He wasn't the main attraction for Northern Virginia Muslims, per se. So he's working his way through Colorado and San Diego State, and some of his radical activities start to pop up during this time. He's part of an investigation tied to a cleric in Yemen named Zindani, Abdul-Majid Zindani, who's the president of a university in Sana'a, Jamiat al-Iman, it's called. This is where John Walker Lind happened to study. A lot of Salafi activism is taught in this university. And I think it has around a quarter. Out of the 4,000 students, I believe 1,000 are foreign. So it's been a cause for concern for U.S. officials and European officials for students coming and then returning to their home countries and potentially being radicalized. So I think the first inquiry into al-Awlaki was on that subject, on his connection with Zindani. And as far as I know, that sort of blew over. It wasn't something hanging over his head. There's no charges. And so around 99-2000, he makes his move from San Diego to Northern Virginia. He had completed a master's in education at San Diego State, but he never completed it. He didn't actually, I talked to someone at the university, and he never actually completed that, but somehow was able to enroll in a PhD program in Washington, at George Washington University, if I'm not mistaken. And so at this, I know in San Diego, he had connection with one of the other hijackers. He seems to have had a relationship with them, and I believe it was more of a mentoring relationship than any kind of operational guidance or instruction. But there are people in the government and some people on the 9/11 commission that disagreed with that and felt strongly that he did have an operational position. I haven't seen any evidence for that, and I know this is someone who has no training whatsoever in battle. So he doesn't understand bomb making. He doesn't know the tradecraft of terrorism, forming cells and managing them. Really no tactical or strategic experience on that front. So I think what he offered them, the reason they came together was a shared viewpoint. They saw the world in a similar way and formed a connection on that basis. And that's really the way that radicalization works. That's how this process has been working at across the country. I won't say in mosques across the country because it doesn't typically happen at the mosque. It may be where like-minded people find each other, but typically the more in-depth discussions about what to do about this problem, how to confront the tyranny and oppression of the United States takes place, in the basements or in people's homes or outside of the mainstream. And I know in Colorado, there was a member of the congregation at the mosque who noted that al-Awlaki and some others were sort of self-segregating and talking about they seem to be dangerous radical issues. And so I think that's typical. You see that in a lot of radicalization cases where the individuals sort of move out of the mainstream. But it's curious for him because he was continuing to serve as an imam for a large congregation. So he was sort of playing both roles. He was playing, he was keeping his public persona as an advocate for the Muslim community in the U.S. and the world, but particularly American Muslims, particularly youth. And at the same time, he was pursuing ways to get young men to get training for jihad and to move in that direction. So he was really pursuing these two concurrently. So in, I believe, 2004, he moves to the UK. Part of this move, I think, was because of the pressure from the FBI. There were agents trying to make a case against him, and there were a variety of reasons this didn't happen, but one of them was political pressure from Muslim advocate groups in the United States that I know from certain people within the FBI at that time that there was concern that political pressures, you know, essentially the idea that they're conducting an anti-Muslim witch hunt, and if they were to arrest this well-known imam in a large congregation, that would fuel that. So that was why he got away in part. But under this pressure, he moves to the UK and sort of then really gets underway with his speaking tour, as it were. Now, most of these are, of course, online. Some of them are telelinked privately to conferences and to groups, and some of them are stay on YouTube and remain public indefinitely. So, but his talks really, after he becomes the imam at Dar al-Hijra and Falls Church, his talks start to, you know, he finds that market, this large Salafi activist market in Northern Virginia, and finds an audience so that people are really, and this was a time where collecting audio tapes was a big deal. All the young men really from the Muslim community are vying to collect the latest tapes from this scholar, that scholar, who gave this talk. And so there's a buzz about him that emerges. And he's a very effective speaker. He's charismatic. He's able to reach and connect with youth in a way that a lot of other imams weren't able to. They might be staunchier. They might just be out of touch. But at the same time, you know, he's not the only English-speaking imam that's come along. I mean, that doesn't account, I don't think, maybe 10% for his popularity. It's partly, in my opinion, this dual identity that he's formed between being Yemeni and being American, so that he's able to communicate the authenticity of what he learned in Yemen. I mean, to an extent, it's the culture of when you're giving a talk, Islamic terms are given in Arabic, and the pronunciation is correct, and he can provide the hadith that backs up what he's saying. That's something a lot of English speakers can't do as fluently, a lot of English-speaking imams, I should say. They're able to, you know, there's a lot of people attempting to rouse young men into action. They don't find the same traction that he does. So I think part of it is because he's that bridge between the two cultures, and he has this authenticity that a lot of others didn't. Another reason, I think, is his the way that he manipulated popular culture. Going back into I was rereading a 2002 sermon he gave this morning, and there's all these references to Malcolm X, to Jamil Alameen, to H.R.A.P. Brown, and the sort of theme of overcoming oppression. Now, this was in 2002, right? So his perspective, his worldview was formed a long time ago. Like Ali al-Tamimi, these guys weren't radicalized at one particular juncture. You know, there's a lot of discussion right now about where did his radicalization occur, and was it in prison in Yemen? Was it, there's actually, frankly, just a lot of questions. I haven't seen any real satisfactory answer. And I think part of the answer is there is no, in his case, there was no radicalization. He didn't become radicalized at any given point. He, like Ali al-Tamimi, they were raised here and then got the bulk of their education overseas. Now, I'm actually more familiar with Ali al-Tamimi's formal education and where he went in Saudi Arabia, but what they brought back with them to the U.S. then was a very austere form of Islam that I think he was attempting to reinterpret into American society, not unlike actually what Sayyid Qutb did when he attended college here in Colorado, what was it, 3 decades before that, where he comes in and sort of interprets everything as decadence and sin, and you know, he's not able to talk to women at all, even covered women, and so there's a gap. You know, even though he's American, he's born here, he's immersed in this American activist community and with a large Muslim congregation at his mosque, but he's not fully American. You know, he's not fully integrated in society. I think to a large extent, he's sort of self-segregated from what he considered to be the more decadent parts of society, and so on. And so, you know, in that context, I actually believe that there's a chance he didn't know anything about 9/11. I don't think he had any operational role with the hijackers. There was a Saudi minister who stayed in the same hotel as three of the hijackers on September 10th. And, you know, at first these coincidences, you kind of think that can't be, that's not coincidence. But in this setting in Northern Virginia, it was, because this is an activist community that had been there for at least three decades before that, from the early 70s. Millions and millions of dollars had been provided from Saudi Arabia, from individuals and the government to set up a wide range of Muslim organizations, so educational ones, exchanges, research institutes, investment firms, really the whole gamut. And those, of course, were the organizations that were raided in Operation Green Quest through 4 or 5 months after 9/11, early 2002. So in that lecture that I was mentioning, it's a March 2002 sermon that Aulaki gives. And he discusses Operation Green Quest and how this is a war against Muslims. We can say no longer this is a war on terrorism, it's a war against Muslims. They've raided IIIT, they raided WAMI, they raided all these organizations, they arrested them, they held them in handcuffs, they held their wives at gunpoint, et cetera, et cetera. And so even from that point on, I mean, this idea that he was once moderate and was there to speak out against 9/11 and he was the, you know, the representative moderate Muslim voice, I think that's a misrepresentation, whether it's from our side or intentionally from his, is maybe both. But this is not someone who was had a dramatic shift in his attitudes in, you know, 2003 or 2004 at some specific point. He's been on this steady track. So I think what turned him to militancy in the in the formal way was after his imprisonment in Yemen. I think he was hardened by that experience, like Zawahiri was when he was imprisoned in Egypt. And so it forces him to look for other means. You know, after that, it's actually a very typical path in radicalization that someone will have all the same concerns and want to address the oppression of their fellow Muslims, of the Ummah, but they'll attempt to do so through nonviolent means repeatedly. And after those have failed or don't produce the results they want, they're more willing to turn to militancy. And I think that was facilitated by his imprisonment in Yemen, although I certainly, again, don't think there's any one key trigger. And so we find him then within the last two or three years in this position where he's becoming more and more popular on the internet. He has a wider audience. And on his Facebook page, which was up until mid-November or late November or something, the majority of the comments are from young people who are just passing along his talks. You know, this is a great talk on spirituality, on this point, on that point, whatever it may have been. It's rarely even a political discussion. There isn't much talk of you know, attacking the U.S. or jihad or anything of that nature. It's really about his ability as an orator and a compelling speaker. And that still accounts for 90% of his popularity, even today. I mean, his tapes are, his CDs and recordings are being sold in a lot of mainstream Muslim outlets, and they're not about jihad. So as the imam in Falls Church said recently, he's a gateway to the unsuspecting, was his quote. I mean, I think that's putting it very mildly. That, but you would find yourself listening one could find themselves becoming a fan of Aulaki, listening to nothing related to jihad or violent activity. And you may find that in 1 out of 10 of his talks leading up to that point. And now there's a tremendous difference in his talks. You know, when he releases a statement, it's a all-out call for jihad on Americans, and he renounces his position that he didn't, you know, that he hadn't taken this up sooner. And I think that's a lot of a combination of the U.S. pushing him into that position and AQAP in Yemen taking advantage of him being in that position, what accounts for his current role. I don't think he has any operational role in al-Qaeda whatsoever. The reason being, he has nothing to offer. This is someone who has no operational training. He's never spent time on a battlefield. He doesn't know how to manufacture a bomb. He doesn't know how to carry out a guerrilla attack. There's plenty of people in Yemen who have been engaged in that sort of activity, whether al-Qaeda related or otherwise, for a long time. And so there isn't a need. He doesn't offer anything from that front. He's also not he's not a cleric. He doesn't have any higher Islamic education. I don't think al-Qaeda is in need of people with master's degrees from San Diego State, per se. So what does he offer? I think what he offers is a stick in the side of the U.S. that, similar to the way they promoted al-Qahtani recently to be a leader of AQAP, he's someone who was imprisoned in Guantanamo Bay, and then he was supposedly rehabilitated by the Saudi system, and then infiltrated the border and rejoined AQAP. And now I think they're promoting him to a leadership position for a similar reason. But this is a great PR opportunity. And so al-Awlaki's fulfilling that role, and AQAP is a smart group, and they're able to take advantage of it, and I think they've done so well. But in my perspective, his tremendous ability is bringing people who are sympathetic to this movement, people who have an inclination already to support the Mujahideen, to support the global jihad, in the defense of their brothers and sisters, people who are, you know, moving in that direction, have that tendency. He's able to get them to actually do something. He's able to, in essence, fire them up. And so it's difficult. It's difficult to give a really good explanation of why he's so popular right now. In a way, I think it's like trying to explain why skinny jeans are popular at the moment. I can't do it. Maybe there's a reason based in the 80s or in people's psychology or in this or that, but it's just a trend, you know. So he is not the first English speaker who was trendy. There are people like Bilal Phillips who will be more popular and influential after him. But for now, he's the man in the spotlight. So I think a great deal of this is charisma that accounts, you know, he's able to reach people, able to reach young people, and really have an impact on them. And his role as a radicalizer, then, is much greater than his role as in trying to organize an attack on the U.S. Embassy in Sana'a or something like that. In a way, anyone can do that. Not anyone, but they have two dozen guys that can do that. But to him, for someone to be able to bring thousands of people a step closer to joining the Mujahideen, to going to a camp, to getting training, that's a tremendous asset for that movement. So I think that's what his significance is. And with that, I'll leave it to Scott.
Great, thank you very much. Scott.
Well, I'll just elaborate on a few points that Chris touched on and begin with the point that Chris was saying he didn't see a turning point where this guy went from moderate to radical or first embraced violence. And I think that's true. There does seem to be an evolution. You know, from his point of view, I think if he were here today, he might say that the world changed, or if you observe the world as it's evolved during his lifetime, he might say it's, you know, it's not me that changed, it's you. And what do I mean by that? Well, a kid who was about his age who grew up in the same neighborhood in Yemen, as Chris mentioned, he'd spent his very early years in the U.S., then went back to Yemen, spent his teenage years in Yemen, and then came back to go to college here. And this friend of his said that it was the Mujahideen against the Soviet Army in Afghanistan that was the inspirational hot topic of the day for young Yemeni men. Some Yemeni men were going off to fight. You know, this guy remembered people coming back with videotapes, you know, of bits and pieces of the fighting over there. They were extremely enthusiastic about this fight. And so then he comes to Colorado State, and during the summer he travels to Afghanistan. I don't know exactly what year, but probably around 92. And he comes back to Fort Collins, Colorado, wearing an Afghan hat and, you know, kind of begging people, ask me where I spent my summer, you know. It's clearly a point of pride with him to have been there. This was like, you know, the great triumph, the Mujahideen against the infidels. And he's living here, and then, it's really 9/11 comes along, and I totally agree that this March 2002 speech, after what are sometimes called the SAR raids, S-A-A-R, for a couple of the institutions that were raided, raids on Muslim institutions where he knows a lot of the people, that seems to have been, his voice is shaking with rage during this talk. That's when he first uses the language, you know, that America's at war with Islam, although it seems to be a little bit metaphorical at the time, but he seems kind of shocked by this. And that comes at a time in the weeks after 9/11 where he seems to have been sort of trying on different roles, partly with the connivance of we in the news media. He is often called upon as a fluent speaker of unaccented English to explain various aspects of Islam, to comment on 9/11, and he reveled in the limelight, according to his colleagues. And he said some very moderate stuff. He said to the New York Times, in the past, we were oblivious, we meaning the Muslim imams. We didn't really care much because we never expected things to happen. Now I think things are different. What we might have tolerated in the past, in terms of rhetoric, we won't tolerate anymore. There were some statements that were inflammatory and were considered just talk, but now we realize that talk can be taken seriously and act upon in a violent, radical way. So he's either sincerely or not so sincerely presenting himself as a moderate guy who's going to, root out this radicalism. But at the same time, his main role is sort of explaining a Muslim point of view and even a sort of, here's why the violence came to America. He really seems to have been set off also by the invasion of Iraq. And, now you got the airstrikes in Yemen. So his list of grievances and his list of proof that the U.S., as he long suspected, is openly at war with Islam now, is a long one. So I think, he sort of revels in his understanding of not only the language, but the sort of American political viewpoint. And in a recent statement, he said, jihad is now as American as apple pie and as British as afternoon tea. And that, he's taunting this country. And what's intriguing about his most recent lengthy pronouncement, which was excerpted on Al Jazeera, and then the full text the full video recently came out, and it's a long talk. But one of the things that's kind of fascinating to see is his analysis of what the U.S. wants versus what he wants is not that different from our analysis. He says what they want is an American, democratic, liberal, passive, and civil Islam. And in a typical note, again showing off his sort of knowledge of the enemy, he cites a RAND report for that, a RAND Corporation report. So he's, that I think is probably a fair description of what many in the United States are seeking. And he's completely broken with that and is seeking a very different brand of Islam. Let me just make a couple of other points quickly. One is, I think Chris kind of hinted at this, but in some ways I've come to believe that his English is almost a little bit misleading in the sense that it disguises the depth of his cultural roots in Yemen and his sort of shaping adolescence in Yemen. And a friend who's close to in the Muslim Student Association at Colorado State talked about how uneasy he was with women. I mean, we're talking about Colorado State, right? I mean, there aren't many guys who are running the other way from women on American college campuses. But he carried that with him very much. He married a distant cousin who was always covered and never, sort of shown to friends right after graduating from college. So this guy remained very Yemeni even as he worked in these American mosques and, certainly absorbed American culture. I would take slight issue with Chris saying that he doesn't have any operational role. I mean, I think... as Chris sort of suggested, in a way, guys to hook up bombs or certainly cannon fodder like Abdul Muttalib, the guy who got on the on the plane, you don't need rare skills necessarily to do that. But you know, I think American authorities believe that Anwar al-Awlaki had an important role in convincing Abdulmutallab to get on that plane. And in that sense, and supposedly he is part of the sort of recruiting, persuading, preparing chain of supply in al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula now. So, you know, certainly the Americans think he has an operational role, and for that reason, earlier this year, he had the distinction of being the first American citizen put on the CIA's official list of you know, approved targets for capture or kill, you know, notably killing, and that raises one final question, which I think we might want to get into in the questions, and that is, to what degree has the United States' attention to this guy, and you know, as a member of the media attention to him, made him what he is today? You know, if you talk to people who mainly follow the jihad through Arabic sources, he was sort of a nobody. But in the English-speaking world, he was very big. But by, you know, as a Yemeni guy I talked to about him said, it was only after the reports started going around that the CIA wanted to kill him that a large number of people started saying, who is this Awlaki guy who the great America wants to kill? And so are we, you know, are we sort of playing to his strength in a way by putting him on a pedestal? And it is certainly true that among those who cover terrorism movements and terrorist groups historically, they've always relied on the reaction or often the overreaction of the enemy. And it's interesting to see that after being accused in the sort of pre-9/11 era of being at war with Islam, you know, and I'm not making any comment here on whether we should or should not have taken any particular step, but from a guy, you know, from the point of view of a young Muslim man who's looking at the world, you know, we now have pretty big wars going on in Afghanistan, Iraq, basically Pakistan, and to a much more limited degree Yemen, and certainly covert stuff in other parts of the Muslim world. So you do wonder to what degree we are generating, as Don Rumsfeld once asked, are we generating more, new recruits for the global jihad than we are capturing or killing? And you know, if you look at the sort of curve of al-Awlaki's fame and influence, it's, you know, he's sort of a case study, I suppose. So let me stop right there.
Great. Thank you very much. I think in many ways, I think any discussion of Anwar al-Awlaki raises more questions than it does answers. And I think many of the points I think that both of you were hitting on, it's not just his language skills or his ability to switch between English and Arabic. And I think there's been a good deal of discussion about how his ability to speak in clear, fluent, idiomatic English and to switch into Arabic, I think, lends a real sense of authenticity and credibility. And I think, for many senses, it's for people who I think are already going a certain direction, I think this is all you need to get even further. I have a number of questions, and I'm. One of the things that I often think about is how popular he is in Yemen, or how popular has he become in Yemen because of what we've done. I think it's something that both of you touched on. I'd like to open it up to questions now. And again, please just introduce yourself before you start, and please ask a question. So who'd like to start? I guess I will. I think one of the things that I've kind of been thinking about is I'm not sure what he's done in Yemen that's a crime. I'm not sure, and I don't know the answer to that question, but I wonder, and I think this is something that came out in his video, all he's doing is explaining and defending what is already known, right? And I think this is a point that you were making. So I think maybe if one or both you could comment on that, like what is it, we want the Yemeni government to do.
Well, I mean, even going back I know that the American agencies, as they slowly became aware of this guy, mostly, you know, as Chris mentioned, there was a brief counterterrorism investigation of him in 1999-2000, but mostly after they discovered his ties to the hijackers, there was a sudden scramble. They interviewed him a number of times after 9/11. But then, and later when he was in London, and later after he went to Yemen, I know there was a very active debate inside the U.S. government as to, you know, sort of essentially where does the First Amendment stop and some kind of terror-related crime begin. You know, this country is much less liable to charge people with crimes related to free expression than many countries, even in Europe. And I also know that there was a dispute inside the American government over his incarceration in Yemen. This is an American citizen being held in Yemen. He was visited by diplomats. He was also visited by the FBI. And at one point, I know the Yemeni government went to John Negroponte, who was then director of national intelligence, and said, "Hey, we got your citizen Aleki in jail." He was originally jailed over a tribal dispute, but they kind of were holding him partly because they knew the U.S. was interested in him. And Negroponte, I'm told, essentially said, "You know, we have no particular objection to his being held," and so they kept holding him for months. And then they came under some pressure from tribes and others to let him go, and they went back to the Americans. I know that the FBI and Robert Mueller, the director of the FBI, had been quite uncomfortable with the idea that an American, that we were sort of conniving in the incarceration without charges of this guy. And so the second time, the U.S. government apparently said, "We have no objection to his being released," and he was released, and the rest is history. But I think, you know, if the Yemeni government has a hard time figuring out what to do with this guy, so did the U.S. government.
Yeah, I think, well, partly you were asking, has he committed any crime in Yemen? Right? I would say you don't actually need to commit a crime to be held in Yemen. so I'm not sure it's essential to act on that basis. But I think the reason they haven't done anything with him, if you look at a map of Yemen in 1965, near Hadramaut, where Aulaki is from, is Upper Aulak, Lower Aulak, and the Aulak Sultanate. Big part of Yemen, that's his family. And he's there, essentially, in his family's kingdom. So arresting him and trying him, handing him over to the Americans, I think, forget it. But even arresting him and trying him there would anger so many tribesmen, which you may know there's a separate insurgency going on in Yemen, three right now, I think. but in the south, there's been a sort of a renaissance of southern culture and identity and you know, a revival of the old South Yemen. It's taken place mainly in Dali and Lahij and areas near Shabwa, where we believe he is. And so there's an internal dynamic, too, in Yemen that it's not worth riling the mass of that thousands of people, really, that are affiliated with that tribe in that area over this one guy. I think that's a part of their inaction.
Yes, sir. There's a microphone coming.
I'm Mark Grandel with the Congressional Research Service. My question is related to what exactly is the role that al-Awlaki has had in some of these cases. Every single time there's a new terrorist event, it's immediately reported that he was, you know, the perpetrator was influenced by al-Awlaki, either his lectures or so forth. What we do know in the Hassan case is that Hassan reached out to him. There were only two emails that al-Awlaki responded to and led some to speculate that he thought maybe he was being entrapped. So all of these other emails that excuse me, that Hassan had sent, al-Awlaki did not respond to. And then there's talk in the case of Abdulmutallab and now about Shahzad that he was influenced. But what do we know in the open source literature about what that was exactly, other than maybe they just listened to his CDs?
I can take a stab at that. The I mean it's a very good question because, you know, somebody said that finding a young Muslim man was influenced by Anwar al-Awlaki is a little bit like finding a Republican was influenced by Rush Limbaugh. I mean, There is an element, and again, this goes to the difficulty that the U.S. government had, at least at earlier times, in sort of pinning a crime on this guy. You know, he says what he wants. People listen or don't listen. The thing that was striking, however, is in a number of cases, I counted a dozen or so before Fort Hood, his material, the more radical material, not the CDs on the life of the prophet and the life of the companions of the prophet and so on, but the more radical material had turned up in about a dozen cases, all English-speaking Muslims in investigations in Britain, that was the more than half, the U.S. and Canada. And, you know, in some ways, it's hard to distinguish cause from effect. If you begin to get radicalized and you go out looking on the web, I mean, I recommend this to everyone. Put Anwar Awlaki under any of his spellings, any of his several spellings, into Google, and you'll be amazed at the number of MP3s posted everywhere. Everybody's got this guy posted somewhere. You can listen to his voice. He's in English for those of us who don't have Arabic. Is it that young guys are getting radicalized and therefore they go out on the web and they find Awlaki and they say, wow, what a great talk. I'm going to put this on my laptop. I'm going to save this to my laptop. Or, you know, that's probably a little more plausible than the alternate scenario where they're, you know, absolutely moderate. They go surfing on the internet and they you know, stumble across a radical talk by Awlaki and the next thing you know, they're ready to plant a bomb. But there is this sort of symbiosis and, you know, when you think about an American Muslim in a relatively small community, also often quite isolated and perhaps not getting a lot of encouragement for any radical thoughts he might be having from his family or his community, this is sort of a virtual community he can join. And I guess the only thing about the Nidal Hassan business I might add is, alas, despite many efforts, we haven't been able to get a hold of those emails, the text of those emails. But certainly, if you listen to what Awlaki himself has said, the first question he recalls Nidal Hassan sending him was, how would it be under the laws of Islam if I were to kill, or if a soldier were to kill his fellow American soldiers because they're about to go out and kill Muslims? And certainly Awlaki indicated that he thought that would be a good idea. And certainly after the fact, of course, he famously posted a posting saying Nidal Hassan is a hero and approved it in retrospect. But you're absolutely right to raise this question.
I think so. Yeah, I would just add that I think he was catapulted into the mainstream media after the Fort Hood shootings. But before that, going back to, you recall in Toronto, there was a plot to do a lot of things, abduct the prime minister and behead him and take over parliament. It was about 18 guys involved. He was involved in that case too. And I think three or four others at least we could point to. But it's a very good question to ask, how was he involved? What is this involvement? And it's really just dialogue, you know. Maybe not even dialogue, we can just say watching in some cases his lectures. You know, these were people, I know in that case they had some sort of video link up with him. But in essence, he's providing inspiration to them. He's providing support and assistance, which is critical. You remember the Fort Dix case, perhaps, in New Jersey. And those guys, there were six of them that had, towards the end of it, they were being monitored closely throughout it, so there wasn't ever really a serious threat there. But they were, towards the end stages, looking for an imam who would legitimize their actions. So in that sense, they weren't being radicalized by an individual. They were seeking one, right, who would not radicalize them further, but give them direction. And so he's provided that. I think that's the most critical aspect of his involvement, and that's maybe all that we know of, frankly.
Professor Mack.
David Mack from the Middle East Institute. Now, this has been a fascinating conversation, and really thank you for it, all three of you. But it does lead me to wonder, as politically difficult as it is for the Yemeni government to prosecute and hold Anwar al-Awlaki, it sort of sounds to me like some good lawyers could mount a pretty strong First Amendment defense in a courtroom in this country And I'm a little bit unsure as to what the precedents are, you know, given that people can preach as long as they don't actually try to kill an abortionist, they can preach that it's a good idea to kill abortionists and other fairly outrageous political speech is protected under our Constitution. Are there any parallel cases where our government has successfully prosecuted people who are preaching jihad, violent jihad of this kind?
Yeah, if I could just add real quickly, there was almost an identical parallel case with Ali al-Tamimi. They were raised in the same way. They were carrying out the same activities, and Tamimi was tried and convicted and is serving life in prison. So I think there certainly is. I mean, that was almost identical cases.
I would add to that just that the Tamimi prosecution was and is quite controversial.
Yeah.
And there's a major appellate effort trying to overturn it and so on. So, but if you believe, you know, what you hear from American intelligence officials,
Anwar al-Awlaki,
at least in recent months, has crossed a line he hadn't crossed before. He allegedly had direct contact with Abdulmutallab before he got on that plane to try and blow it up over Detroit. So I think if what's alleged about his more recent activities is correct, there may be a much more direct case of even attempted murder and the same kinds of charges that are, that Abdulmutallab himself is facing, or conspiracy certainly. But we haven't seen that evidence, but that's certainly what's alleged. But it does raise also the uncomfortable question of
If you're targeting
him for death potentially
by a missile fired from a drone, as a former CIA lawyer pointed out to me,
under the law, if we want to eavesdrop on Anwar al-Awlaki's cell phone, which we presumably do, we have to go to the FISA court, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court,
and lay out the evidence that he's
an agent of an international terrorist group,
and get a warrant. But as far as anyone knows, the approval process for designating him to potentially be
murdered or killed has
not gone to the judicial branch. It's been strictly within the executive branch. Supposedly went to the NSC
for approval. But it does seem like there's something kind of out of whack when Congress has passed something that says you need a warrant to listen to somebody, but
you don't need a warrant to kill him.
Next. I think this is a really interesting point about the difference between advocating violence or inciting violence and actually stepping over the line. Something that as I've listened to both of you speak, something that comes to mind is, well, one way or another, there's something after Anwar al-Awlaki. And what is that like? Either what are the implications for kind of big picture war on terror or radicalization and there are other guys out there like him, as you both have noted. So I wonder if you could both kind of comment a little bit on that.
Well, I think in his case now, it's sort of lose-lose for the U.S., which is why AQAP has been so excited to get him on their media docket there. His videos are increasing in popularity. As we know, after the Fort Hood shooting and the Christmas Eve attempt, these things happen. It grows to a wider and wider audience who are familiar with his name. No, none of us pronounce it right, but we're familiar with it. I think in death or in life, either way, he's going to grow in popularity to a certain point, and then he'll fade, like all trends, I think. So there will be other English-speaking, French-speaking, Italian-speaking, cross-cultural imams that are able to find an audience, and just, I think, as culture changes, those people who are able to best be in touch with, to best connect to a youth audience, there will be there may be another 5 Al-Awlakis within the next 5 years. I think that's probably the most likely possibility. And it's shown, I think, a model for... to step back for a second, I don't think someone could say this is what Al-Awlaki did over the last 15 years, we can replicate this and I can become the next one. I don't think there's any formula for it. Again, it's like trying to assess why a trend is trendy. But I think it's the means of finding an audience on the internet now, or finding an audience through the internet. It just makes the whole process so much easier that more and more people are going to be competing for this space. There's going to be people continually trying to compete to represent the Ummah, to speak on behalf of Muslims, to be the one speaking out in defense of all these atrocities, wherever they may be, Gaza or Afghanistan or Iraq or that's been going on for 10, 20, 30 years, and that will continue.
To add to that, one thing that struck me in reporting on Al-Awlaki is that, as I said, he's all over the web. You can find him out there, and that's not going away. So if he's hit by a Hellfire missile tomorrow, it barely changes his status and his influence, and arguably it would enhance his status to become a martyr. You can kind of imagine all the flowery tributes pouring in from branches of Al-Qaeda around the world. You can't remove this guy now from the web. If you take postings down, his followers will put them back up. So that also, as the U.S. tries to think about this in a strategic way, that's an interesting thing to consider, is that, is his death actually a desirable goal, or could he be more dangerous after death, at least for a period of time? And the other thing that's made him, I think, a subject of so much fascination recently is that, as you know, in 2009, there was what seems to be a real uptick in the number of U.S.-based, U.S.-focused terrorist plots, almost all of them broken up, and some, a couple of them in the category of sort of totally controlled by the FBI, sort of from beginning to end with, fake bombs supplied by the FBI, the kinds of things that never pose much of a threat. But you also have Najibul Azazi and so on. And you also have a case which I think is troubling to a lot of people, including me. I've reported on this, and that's the 5 young guys from Northern Virginia who headed off to try and join the jihad against American troops in Afghanistan, allegedly. They're being held in Pakistan. They kind of wander around Pakistan looking for a jihadi group that could hook them up with the war. And they seem kind of hapless. But when you go back and study their histories, there's a little bit of variation. One had a minor criminal record. One was a stellar dental student at Howard University. But they're very diverse. They're from different national backgrounds, all U.S. citizens. And the idea that these guys, growing up in Northern Virginia, could kind of look around and say, the best option for me is to go off and sacrifice myself in Afghanistan, it's a kind of shocking thing. And I don't know of any influence Al-Awlaki had. They're the kind of guys who undoubtedly went on the web and listened to Al-Awlaki. But I think that is the, I think, another reason why when you ask what comes after Al-Awlaki, what a lot of people are worried about, I think, is the erosion of this notion that the American Muslim community was not particularly susceptible to radicalization. I think that remains true. But the thing is, you need so few people. A guy like Shahzad, look at what he's done with an incompetent bomb placed on Times Square. Enormous impact. You just need a handful of these guys to have huge impact. And so if there has been, through the work of a guy like Al-Awlaki, a kind of erosion of the barriers against extremist violence among young Muslim men in this country, or even a handful of young Muslim men in this country, that's a very significant thing.
Well, I think, as I tried to say earlier, I think this case really demonstrates how complex and difficult a lot of these questions are. It strikes me that listening to what both of you had to say, Al-Awlaki is not going to go away no matter what, and most likely will only become much more popular. And I think, I didn't look this morning, but you can still get all of these sermons and all of these addresses online. And War Against Islam is an incredibly powerful speech. And I think it's this is only kind of emblematic of a larger problem, but I wonder, you know, in how we are dealing with this problem if we aren't making it worse. And I think that's a very interesting question. Are there any other? Yes, sir.
I think there is. I mean, I asked people this. I went visit all of Awlaki's mosques in this country and talked to a lot of people at each of them. And I would say that there is a disillusionment, not surprisingly. And this is probably not restricted to Muslims, but anyone who puts high hopes in, you know, feels strongly about a subject and puts high hopes in any presidential candidate. On the right or on the left, Republican or Democrat, they're inevitably disappointed by what actually happens on the ground because these problems are so difficult, and American presidents tend to hug to the middle anyway. But you know, here was a guy who with a Muslim name, a Muslim father, who also early on went and gave that speech in Cairo, and yet you know, certainly if you read what Awlaki says about the great Pharaoh Obama. He's trying to encourage this sense of disillusionment. If you thought America was going to change its stripes, well, forget about it. You know, all he's done is increase the drone strikes, killing, you know, innocent Muslims. And so they're playing that card, and maybe that sense of disillusionment is playing into the equation a little bit.
Yeah, it didn't change Al-Qaeda's approach when Obama was elected. You remember Zawahiri came out with his talk against him within the first year near the Cairo talk, I think. Mm. And it was frankly racist. I mean, it was pretty unsavory, I think. And it, as far as I can understand, or as far as I could see, that didn't gain a big audience. So there isn't the same easy trigger issue that they have. But in reality, none of the policies have changed. So I think it's not difficult for them to make an argument that, hey, whoever you elect, there's no difference, you know. And the situation in Gaza, with Israel, the Palestinian question, is no closer to being resolved. It doesn't seem any closer during this administration. Iraq and Afghanistan remain very active battlegrounds, obviously. And we've been engaged in firing missiles into Yemen, and in addition to that, giving a large degree of intelligence and tactical support to Yemeni services. So, even on that level, yeah, I mean, it's hard to say that you know, he's much more likable, sure, but for jihadis, no, it doesn't. It's not game over. You know, you guys won.
Yes, ma'am, in the front.
My name is Dalia Mugahed. I direct the Center for Muslim Studies at Gallup. And I want to thank you for your talk. There's one point that I'm still unclear about, and that is, why can't the Yemeni government arrest Al-Awlaki like they did one time before and simply hand him over for trial in the United States? Why couldn't that be a route that the U.S. government could pursue instead of making him a target for assassination?
Chris, you might be the best person to answer that.
I mean, I think the first thing that comes to mind, in addition to the level of political will inside Yemen to want to do this, or for the reasons I think that Chris had laid out about internal Yemeni politics, is that the Yemeni constitution forbids the extradition of its nationals abroad. That's the end of the story. And this has been a problem between the United States and Yemen on a number of issues, right? There are several individuals, Albano and Badawi, who are wanted in this country for terrorist crimes, and the Yemeni government will not extradite them because of their nationality, citizenship. Dad, if you want to add anything to that?
I guess the only other aspect of that is that now that his profile is so high, it was one thing when they grabbed him in 2006 in this tribal dispute and locked him away. You know, he was a very low-profile guy at that point. Now if they grab him, he's sort of called on the Aluk tribe to, you know, come to his rescue. And there have been competing statements from tribal leaders as to whether they're going to stick with him or let him go. But there's no question that that would be a very high-profile event in Yemen and certainly in the world. So it poses much more of a political dilemma, I would think, for the Yemeni government.
Anyone else like to ask a question? Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. My name is Laura Provencher. I'm with the University of Arizona. My question is, you both have been speaking about how, in many ways, the American media, public government has almost propelled them to this stature. And we're not sure now what we can do in response. Either way is a difficult decision. But what about the future? What should be done differently so that this is not a continual, we're stuck in response mode, but we're preventing things such as this?
I'm just a reporter. I don't say what we should do. I mean, you know, I will say that there are, you know, other countries, European countries, and many Muslim countries, Saudi Arabia, Indonesia, have done much more along the lines of counter-radicalization, either individual rehabilitation programs where you take someone who is seen to be an extremist and, you know, try to brainwash them or unbrainwash them, and then more general counter-radicalization efforts. The U.S. has not done much of that and is very nervous about it because the government is not really supposed to get on its hobby horse and start expressing itself, particularly about religious matters. So it's a very tricky thing. But some people might say that, certainly many people in the American Muslim community have done this on a small scale, some of the Muslim groups, and some think that more needs to be done in terms of putting out, you know, not allowing a guy like Aluki to go unanswered out there on the, you know, in cyberspace, to give young people an alternate view and a view of a guy like Aluki that they can sort of, you know, at least put some kind of argument on the other side.
I would say a little bit off the direct question, but I think it's relevant here. You mentioned those five guys from Northern Virginia who were arrested in Pakistan recently. I found that case fascinating for the reason that they had been active in the local ICNA chapter, in the Islamic Circle of North America. That's an organization that's been in the U.S. since, I believe, 1971, and was part of a longer activist tradition of Islamist activists who came to the U.S. In the early 60s and set up in Urbana-Champaign in Illinois. And for most of their history, they were not concerned with preventing radicalization, we'll say that. I think it's fair to say they were more concerned with pursuing anti-Muslim discrimination than worrying about their people becoming radicalized in the terrorism issue. After that happened, that was the first time I can recall very clearly that they were going to take action about it. They wanted to set up programs to intervene. They wanted to be involved. And obviously, it's out of self-preservation to a degree, but that's still a change from what was happening in the past over the last 10, 15 years. And so I think encouraging more of that is the answer, that you have to be involved with the Muslim community, period. You have to, that's more of an issue, I think, for law enforcement and for policing. But the models, I worked with some people in Australia who had, I believe, who are ahead of us in countering radicalization. And they had learned a very simple motto that I think they learned from the UK, that communities defeat terrorism. It was learned from the IRA. It's really the only way that that can be done. That you can defeat radicalization, to counter-radicalize people, I think, is almost an impossible objective, or to prevent them from, you know, you can't prevent people from liking bad thoughts. I don't think we can be in that business. But you can learn to address the signs, and most importantly, you can work with people in these communities that know the signs even more acutely, who are more aware of them than we are. And I think that's the best model. In terms of Awlaki's jump to stardom, so to speak, through the media in the U.S., yeah, I mean, it was just, I think it was a confluence of influence. I don't think we, or of events, excuse me. I don't think we can sit back and say, well, if we just ignored him and didn't speak about it, he wouldn't be there, you know. We can't. So it's really, I don't know that it's possible to do that on a media or government level wholesale, but at the community level with law enforcement, I think that's where it can be most effective.
I think Chris makes a great point that you can't just ignore these points. I think to pick up on something that Scott was saying, I think there are opportunities to respond to some of these messages. I mean, in a war against Islam, I'd say, I don't know if it's what, 75-80% is probably factual, but it's that last 20% or so that is kind of goes off message, and there is an opportunity to respond and correct some of those falsehoods. Just as in this last video that came out 2 weeks ago, I guess, where Awlaki says, everyone in America is a target because they all pay taxes and they all are responsible for electing this government. And anybody who spends time in this country would know that that's not true, right? There's a huge range of opinions on American policy and on American policy in the Muslim world, to be sure. So I think there is an opportunity to draw out the differences and say this is not a factual representation of the United States that's being advanced. Yes, ma'am.
Make the point that there actually was a very eloquent response to that last message by another popular American imam named Zayed Shaker, and he went through not only a factual refutation but a religious refutation according to law, very detailed, very well cited, and very authoritative, and that's been circulating among Muslim Americans, but it hasn't gotten media attention. And I think that just like we can't ignore Awlaki and his messages, I think that these responses also need to be covered.
Well, that, and I would say, I mean, there's people since 9/11 that have been saying, where are the moderate Muslim voices? And they're everywhere. I mean, they're everywhere. It wasn't hard to find them before that or after that or during. But they're not newsworthy, people saying everything is fine. You know, you're not. So, unfortunately, I don't know the mechanism of bringing those voices, having whether it's a governmental mouthpiece or media or private, but you know, if there should be a way to amplify those voices so that they have equal time in the spotlight, but that hasn't, it's never been the case so far, right?
Oh, I'm glad you make that point. You're a New York Times colleague. It's kind of an indictment for the U.S. media that this is not newsworthy.
Well, you know, far be it from me to defend the U.S. media, but there is an element of what is news. You know, we don't write about all the planes that did not crash, and so when these five guys go off to seek jihad in Pakistan, that's news. The 500,000 guys who did not go off, may be much more sensible in a way, but they don't lend themselves to news. But I think we are obligated to do a better job than we've done of looking at the sort of dynamics within the Muslim community in this country. And one thing that strikes you when you go out on the hustings and visit mosques and so on, especially as a non-Muslim reporter, is you find that, there is this dilemma that American Muslims often face, which is, you know, if you say, or, you know, a couple years ago, if you said you were against the Iraq war, it's like, well, so what? You know, as an American, you know, American against the Iraq war, well, you know, what was that, 50% of the population or something, right? And the other 50% was for it for a while. And, but if you're Muslim and you say you're against the Iraq war, ooh, there's something, you know, potentially devious about that. Or, you know, how do you feel about the Afghan war? How do you feel about this and that? And so there is this, it's sort of like, I suppose, the left in the days of Red Scare and McCarthyism and so on, where, you know, so-and-so is connected with so-and-so. You know, so-and-so attended the same mosque that Awlaki had preached at. What's this mean? And so there is a lot of sort of suspicion, most of it, I think, without any grounds whatsoever, that's out there.
I think I'd like to thank both of you for coming out to add to this discussion today. I was really hoping that this this conversation would do a lot to kind of explain and elaborate and add some nuance to some of the discussions that we've been having about Anwar al-Awlaki, and I think we've definitely done that, in addition to raising a whole lot of other questions that we need to focus on in the future. Both of our speakers have written excellent pieces, which you can find outside. Chris has a piece in the West Point Sentinel from a few months ago, a great profile of Anwar al-Awlaki, and Scott also has an excellent New York Times Magazine article, which you can get outside. Please join me in thanking our speakers.